let's get started.
Before we get back to Hardy Weinberg, a couple of things. One is that homework number one assignment is posted now on the website due by the end of the day next Friday. And, you know, you submit it by email. If you can't figure out what my email address is, you can get it through the Department of Genome Sciences website or the Department of Biology website, but you can also get it by going to my lab's website, which you just type Felsenstein Lab and you'll get it. And there is my personal page, and there is a link to my CV, and it's on the CV. And let me just put it up here. I think it's the easy way. Joe@GS as in Genome Sciences, Washington, edu. There's also a university official email address that you'll get through the university, but it gateways to that, so either one is fine. Okay. The textbook. I have the copy I'm teaching from here for 2 years ago. I have a sign-up sheet. I'll supply a pen. Who want the pen back? And for those who want to sign up to commit to pay in the vicinity of $28 on Monday for a copy looking something like this of the textbook, I will circulate this and keep circulating it as more people trickle in. It's just a just print. Those who want that, print your names on it. Don't sign, because I probably can't read your signature and then I won't know who you are. Okay. Any other issues about the course or the material that we're covering so far? Any question or question-like utterances? Okay. We were tangled in Hardy Weinberg. We had made a big table of all the mating types, given their frequencies, given the assumption that everybody contributes equal numbers of offspring for each mated pair, and they all survive equally, and nobody comes into the population, and the Mendelian genetics works without any mutation, and the genotype frequencies, these things, are equal in both sexes, and you're in an infinite population, which means that the expected frequencies exactly work out. It's exactly like tossing coins, where if you toss them an infinite number of times, you get the true probability of heads. Okay, so you end up with these expressions. It's what made population genetics hard to do in the decade of the 1910s, the 1900s. And then in 1908, Hardy and Weinberg independently come up with this great simplification. And one of the ways to get it, I think they saw it intuitively how it would work and then verified it, is to take these and factorize them. You can say, here's an expression. If you look at it a little bit, you'll see that it looks like a perfect square. It's very similar to a polynomial like 1 plus x plus a quarter x squared, and you may think, oh, 1 plus a half x quantity squared. It's very much like that. So you can write this as p plus a half capital Q all squared. Similarly, for the other homozygote, it's a half Q plus R squared. And then if you look at the one in between, now that's less obvious, but basically what it's going to be is twice P plus a half Q times a half Q plus R. And you can sort of multiply that out in your head and you will see that it's equal to the other expression. And these quantities, P plus a half Q and a half Q plus R, are magic. And what they are has a very simple interpretation. It's what has come to be called, somewhat inaccurately, the gene frequencies, or sometimes allele frequency, because gene frequency is, and I'll call them little p and little q, hoping that I can make those distinguishable on the board from the big p's and the big q's, because what p, the frequencies are p plus a half q is little p, and a half q plus r is big, is little q. Okay, so those are the frequencies of the two alleles, big A and little a. Now, the name is not great. When you say gene frequency, you're equating a gene with an allele, not a gene with a locus. Actually, the word gene is at least sort of threefold ambiguous, because if I have a copy, let's say I had a copy of a particular mutant, do I say that the word, the gene, is the particular copy, or is it the particular allele that that copy has, or is it the particular locus? Those are all valid uses of the word gene, which it's unfortunate that the field of genetics and genomics has this ambiguity in one of its most basic terms. In this case, gene means allele, so these are sometimes called allele frequencies. So in that case, of course, what you've got is the classic Hardy-Weinberg result, little p squared twice little p times little q and little q squared. Very, very simple result. They look very much alike. For a good reason, they look very much like binomial terms in a binomial distribution, where you toss the coin twice with probability of heads p, little p. Okay, well, that's fine. Sometimes this is referred to as Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. We'll come back to that in a moment. But I prefer to refer to those as Hardy-Weinberg proportions. They're the proportions that result from random mating under the simplifying assumptions that I gave. And one of the things that happens is that when you get this result, you may say, well, that's fine, and we started out with frequencies big P, big Q, and big R, which need not be these Hardy-Weinberg proportions. Then we computed the Hardy-Weinberg proportions. That's going forward one generation. Now, what happens if we go forward another generation? And the answer is we don't have to work our way through the entire table again. We can simply use this result. We can simply say for the next generation that we'll compute P again. So we'll get the new P, and that will be, let me see if I can get it better. It'll be the frequency of big A, big A, that's P squared, plus half the frequency of the heterozygote, and that's 2pq. And of course, you immediately see the half cancels the 2, and then you get p squared plus pq, and then you look at it, and then you perform the basic mathematical, sophisticated mathematical technique that we'll be using. You look at it and say, oh, there's a p in every term, so let's bring it out front, p times p plus q. Then we get the other. We use our other powerful mathematical technique that we'll use a lot, which is we will see quantities like this, little p plus little q. Now, the gene frequency is the proportion of copies of the locus that have the big A allele. So this is the proportion of the big A allele. This is the proportion that have the little a allele. There is no other kind of allele here. What is this quantity going to be? It'll be 1. Whenever you have the frequencies of everything added up, that should be 1 if you've done your bookkeeping correctly. So we can cancel that out and just get little p. What does that say? It says that the gene frequency computed in the initial population never changes. It goes forward to the next generation. When you compute it, it is 1. And when you then, sorry, not 1, it's little p. And it continues to be little t because you can go back through this argument as many times as you want and you'll always get, you know, it'll always be the same. And then the proportions of genotypes in that second generation will once again be the Hardy-Weinberg proportion. So you go from the initial proportion, which need not be in Hardy-Weinberg proportions, through this machinery here. For example, if I had 0.5 as the frequency of big P, 0.2 the frequency of big Q, and 0.3 the frequency of R, the gene frequency is equal to 0.5, the capital P, plus a half the frequency of the heterozygote, and that's 0.6. Little q is 0.3 plus a half of 0.2, 0.4. The proportions, the Hardy-Weinberg proportions then are 0.6 squared, that's 0.36, 0.4 squared, 0.16, twice their product, that their product is 0.24, so it's 0.48. So you can see right away the Hardy-Weinberg proportion is not the same as the initial frequencies. Yes, please.
I must have lost you somewhere in here. But
that's a polite way of saying I probably made a mistake. But
no,
yeah.
Where I'm getting confused is little p and little q, are they related to big P and big Q?
Essentially not. That is, they are a consequence of those initial frequencies.
Okay.
Through this formula here. But the fact that those are both called P is just me being arbitrary.
Okay. So, like, little p and little q are not two alleles.
Little p and little pq are the frequencies of the two alleles.
Two alleles.
Okay.
What?
Big P is the frequency of the genotype. Big Q is actually the heterozygote, so it's not in any sense a parallel to little q.
Oh, okay.
I think that's where the terminology is a little confusing.
Okay. So little p and little q refer to, like, you know, one allele, two allele, and big P refers to the genotype of an individual.
The genotype, big A, big A. The particular big A, big
right.
A genotype. And the Q is a heterozygote, and R the other homozygote.
Okay.
Thank you. I see the misleading quality of using P and Q here and using P and Q there. And I've been giving the course for 30-odd times, and you're the first person to bring that up. Okay. I missed it entirely. Okay, so you go from a Hardy-Weinberg, whatever the initial frequencies were, which weren't in Hardy-Weinberg proportions, into Hardy-Weinberg proportions, which in this case involves fewer of the big A, many more of the heterozygote, and fewer of the other homozygote. People refer to that as the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. I think that's a little misleading, because it suggests that if I change the genotype frequencies to anything else, that will somehow magically pop back to these numbers, but they won't. If I change them to other genotype frequencies that don't have those same gene frequencies, that have different gene frequencies, say I go in and I kill off all the little a's, that will increase the gene frequency of big A and decrease the gene frequency of little a. You get different gene frequencies as a result, and the next generation after random mating will not be in these particular proportions. They'll be in Hardy-Weinberg proportions, but at a new gene frequency. So if you do anything that changes the gene frequency, it won't pop back to the same gene frequency. It won't pop back to the original Hardy-Weinberg proportions. So the word equilibrium, I'd actually prefer that it be forgotten, and people say Hardy-Weinberg proportions. This is a very simple result. The other thing that should be said is it's equivalent to, there's a principle that says that random mating is equivalent to random union of gametes. It's as if you took a big pot and you had everybody produce gametes, and you put the gametes in the pot and stirred, and then picked pairs of gametes out of the pot. And if the pot is big enough, and everybody contributes gametes fairly, then what you get is a pot that where the two possible alleles, each gamete has one allele, are in these proportions. And then, thus, when you combine them at random, the probability that you pick twice and get big A's both times is just p squared. So random mating involves individuals coming together at random, producing gametes. The gametes get together and make diploid offspring. But a random offspring from the resulting pool of offspring is the equivalent. It comes from a random parent and another random parent, each of which produces an allele, and that's equivalent to going back to the original population and just taking somebody and picking one of their two alleles and taking somebody else and picking one of their two alleles and putting them together. And that's equivalent to what you get if you were making a giant pot of gametes and drawing out of it. So the other thing that this does, which is really incredibly important and which sort of set off work in population genetics after 1908, it caused a boom of work after 1908, was that now people did not have to mess around with these horrible expressions involving the original genotype frequencies and work their way through to new genotype frequencies. They could just start thinking of the gene frequency. That is, the gene frequency is a kind of, you know, in models like this, is kind of underlying reality. That doesn't much matter what the genotypes are doing. As long as you know what the gene frequencies are doing, you can simply put those, put individual copies of the gene at those frequencies together at random, and that will be the genotypes of the next generation. This holds, by the way, for haplotypes with multiple loci producing diploid genotypes with multiple loci. Again, it's the haplotype frequencies that count, not the exact genotypes of their parents. Okay, and once you get focused on that, everything becomes much more simple. Okay, now there's a final additional property of all this that resolves a paradox, a problem that came up right after Darwin published The Origin of Species. And I'm going to put down the screen here to show you a picture of somebody. I hope the projector turns itself on. We'll see if it does. Okay. And that is a man called Fleming Jenkin. Not well known these days. Well, his name will come up on the projection once it decides, yeah, it's projecting. It will ultimately show us what is going on here. Okay, there we go. There we go. So this guy, I think I better lower. Yeah, so let's turn it off. Fleming Jenkin was an engineer. He was a professor of engineering at the University of Edinburgh in the mid-1800s. This is a book about his life. He was very important in the early history of electrical engineering. The electrical engineering building, it's a more modern building at the University of Edinburgh, is the Fleming Jenkin building, named after him. This looks like a modern cartoon of him. It was actually drawn in 1883 when the university was celebrating its centennial, and they commissioned somebody to do cartoon portraits of some of the important professors, and so he qualified. He was a popular professor. Now, the way he comes into our story is not that he was an important electrical engineer, important in teaching it. It's not that he was a friend of Lord Kelvin and worked with him on laying the transatlantic cable. It is that Lord Kelvin, his buddy Lord Kelvin, had a calculation of the age of the Earth using one of the things he did was to say, let's assume that the sun is burning fuel. How long would it take the fuel to be used up in the sun? And Lord Kelvin came up with a figure, I think it was around 100,000 years, that was too short for evolution to really have happened. And this was raised as an objection against evolution in the period immediately after the publication of The Origin of Species. Jenkin was a friend of Kelvin's and had worked with him, and he came up with another objection. And his objection was actually very clever and very correct, given something about genetics. Of course, nobody knew about genetics. There was really only one person who knew about genetics in those days, and he was off in Moravia, and that was Gregor Mendel, and nobody knew about his work. But Jenkin, let's see if I think I should put the screen back up, the projector off somehow here. The blue thing will go away. So Jenkin said, well, suppose that inheritance operates as everyone thought it did then, by what's called blending inheritance, that in fact there was a hereditary substance of some sort. And when the gametes came together, the hereditary substances were combined, and people analogized it, for example, to mixing paints. You mixed white paint with red paint, you got pink paint. And in effect, what that saying is that if you get a homozygote, of course it will produce big A's, and this will produce little A's. Nobody knew about homozygotes or diploidy then. But in that scheme, there's a difference. Unlike Mendelism, a big A and a little A producing a gamete would be imagined to produce a gamete that is somehow intermediate between them. So what I'll do is say, we'll make it a medium-sized A. That is, all the gametes coming out of this will be medium-sized A's. So, if a gamete having the effect of a big A and the gamete of a little A the alleles of the effect of big A and little A get together in a diploid produce a gamete, it won't be the big A or little A, unlike Mendelism. It'll be an intermediate allele. And there will be this averaging effect where the effect of alleles will be continually changed every generation by encountering other alleles and averaging with them, and in effect mixing the fluids. And what Fleming Jenkin did, and I will not go through it, but he did it correctly, was to calculate that the result of this would be that the variability of the hereditary stuff in a population would be continually decreasing by this averaging. What you can do is you can do a calculation of variances, and you can show that the variance, in a statistical sense, of the genetic variances will be going down by half every generation. And so very quickly the genetic variability of a population under a scheme of blending inheritance will disappear. And so Fleming Jenkin wrote a long review of Darwin's Origin of Species, not in the year it was published, but 8 years later in 1867. He raised this issue and said, look, this whole thing won't work because the genetic material will average out and variability will disappear so rapidly that basically natural selection will stall out by running out of variability. In fact, what you can show is its progress in the first generation, in the second generation will be a certain amount, in the second generation will be half as much, then a quarter as much, then an eighth as much. The total progress can't be any more than twice the original generation. This criticism worried Darwin. Darwin was intimidated by mathematics. And he sort of saw the point of it, and he said, gee, I don't know. And then he, in later editions of The Origin of Species, he added more material on Lamarckian effects, basically, on the possibility that environmental effects could change, could create variability in the genetic material. So Darwin had to accommodate by sort of emphasizing some somewhat Lamarckian effects on producing genetic variability in the face of this criticism. We look at it today, it's a very uncomfortable concession for him to have made. But the whole thing is based on a wrong idea about how genetics works, because of course we know that what actually happens is a half big A and a half little a, or the gametes, produced. No medium-sized A's are produced. So once you take into account Mendelism, the whole problem that Fleming Jenkin raised, was a very clever problem, completely disappears. And genetic variability in the population doesn't go away. I'll get to you in a second. Well, let me get to you now. No, that's fine. Go ahead.
But it wasn't Darwin kind of right, because so you can have a single genotype which has a different phenotype depending on the environmental condition. And so if you have like big A and big A compared to little A and little A, they'll have different degree maybe of plasticity in their ability to respond to different environments. And so evolution or natural selection will act on them differentially.
Well, it will do that, but what will not happen is that those two alleles, which might respond differently to the environment, yes, will not merge together and produce an intermediate allele as a result of being together in the same parent.
Oh.
There isn't the blending that,
So Darwin was trying to argue that.
Well, everyone in those days believed that something like blending inheritance happened. Jenkin believed it, and Darwin believed it. Everybody believed it. Nobody really had the exact details. Darwin was worried about the fact that he didn't understand heredity, and he wrote a whole book famously trying to put forward a scheme called pangenesis, a scheme of inheritance, and it didn't convince very many people, and it was wrong. This problem, which was a big, big problem for the quantitative understanding of how natural selection worked and what happened to variability in populations, basically evaporated as soon as Mendelian genetics was understood. And you can see that what goes on here is, if you get to gene frequencies, little p and little q, and you go forward a generation, in the next generation, of course, little p doesn't change, neither does little q. If little p doesn't change, then necessarily little q doesn't change, because they have to add up to 1. So the gene frequencies, once they throughout the whole process, basically never change. The amount of variability in the population does not go down as a result of random mating in an infinite population. And know anything. No migration, no mutation, no natural selection, no finite population. Once we take those into account, of course, things can and do change, and that'll be a major theme of the course. Okay, so there is the Fleming-Jenkin objection. The other thing I want to do is to talk about multiple alleles, and then if I have a moment, talk about different gene frequencies in the two sexes. Let me start out with multiple alleles. Let's see what we do here. I'm going to erase this again and say, well, how does it all work if you have multiple alleles? And the short answer is it works out the same. It's just that you have a lot more subscripts. Basically, you can have, if you have multiple alleles, let's say you had 8 alleles, you can have genotypes that have genotypes like A4, A6. Okay, so the 4th allele together with the 6th allele. You have a genotype frequency which we'll call capital P sub 4, 6. Capital P will be genotype frequency of a diploid genotype. So the genotype frequencies. And of course, there'll be 64 of those. Let's see. So there's an example of the genotype frequency. And now you can also compute gene frequencies, and you compute the gene frequencies basically the same way. Now the method, you can think of it two different ways. It's what we were doing with two alleles. One of them is to say the gene frequency is obtained by going into the parents and simply counting copies of each allele. So if you want to know what the gene frequency of allele 4 is, that's a little p sub 4, so this will be gene frequency. What will that be? Well, you take all the genotypes that have a 4 in them, or two 4s, so there'll be the genotype 4-4, which will give you A4A4, which will have a genotype frequency of P, capital P sub 4-4. And then you'll have a whole bunch of genotypes that are have one copy each. So it'll be P1-4, P2-4, P3-4, and then we're going to skip P4-4, we've already got it, P4-5. Let's call it 5-4, okay, et cetera, all the way up to P8-4. And then you'll also have the genotypes that have a 4 in the first position. So there'll be 4-1, 4-2. And I'm distinguishing between those in these P. So P46 is the frequency of A4A6. It's not the frequency of A6A4, which is in theory a distinguishable gene. That is, if you could go into the individual and sequence its genes, you might be able to make the distinction. P45, etc., P48. But when you're adding all those up, you have to take into account the fact that except for that first one, everybody has one copy of 4, so only half their copies are 4. So in fact, you're going to have to put a 1/2 out here and a 1/2 there. And that's your formula for what the gene frequency is. Makes life a little easier if you take the P44 and split it up, put half of it in here, P44, and half of it down here, P44. So, because then you can see what you're doing is you're taking the table of all possible genotypes, 1, 2, 3, up to 8, 1, 2, 3, to 8, and you're adding up the 4's column and the 4's row, and you're adding up the frequencies of those multiplied by 1/2. So everything in the 4's column gets multiplied by half, everything in the 4's row gets multiplied by half, and since you add those two up, the 4-4 one gets counted once instead of a half. Anyway, It's straightforward if you just think of yourself going into those genotypes and adding the frequencies of the relevant row and column in, but taking into account how many copies of 4 that they've got. Okay. Then what happens as a result of randomating? Well, I could do an enormous calculation of all possible mating types, of which there would be a great many, and do the table the same way, but I'm just going to simply use the principle that random union of gametes is equal to random mating, is equivalent in its results to random mating. And if I do that, and I say to myself, okay, in the next generation, what is the frequency, the genotype frequency of let's say A4, A6, and the answer will be, we'll have a set of gene frequencies, P, little p1, little p2, and so on, all the way up to little p8, and we'll say it's going to be p4, little p4, little p6, the product of the gene frequencies. Since I am distinguishing between the two different diploids, you don't put a factor of 2 on it, because that'll be a different genotype. So it works out the same. And you can show very easily, and I do show in the notes, that if you take these new Hardy-Weinberg proportions and you extract and you get gene frequencies from them, that the results are the same. You'll come up with these same gene frequencies. So the gene frequencies, again, never change through the process. The genotypes are, in effect, temporary associations of genes, but Mendelian segregation is as if the genes just fell apart at the end, and half the gametes get one and half the gametes get the other. So it's, in a sense, it's as if the genes are these indestructible particles that are proceeding through the process, getting rearranged by random mating into pairs, but then falling apart again. So the gene frequencies never change. You go into Hardy-Weinberg proportions from in the first generation, and you then stay in them, and the gene frequencies never change through the whole process. Everything is exactly the same. So multiple alleles is then pretty straightforward if you don't mind being numbed by a huge number of subscripts, basically. And if you just keep track of the way I'm doing it, that the genotype frequency is is different quantity than it would be for the same two alleles arranged in the other direction, that would be P64, for example. Then everything works out like this. So if anybody, stop me if this is confusing. But what I want to do is just declare that to work out the same with multiple alleles. Weinberg actually worked it out with multiple alleles in his initial paper, which Hardy didn't. And then I want to just quickly skip from that to the another section of the first chapter. And that's the question of what happens when the genotype frequencies of the two sexes are different. But before that, let's answer this question. After random mating, yes. But you could imagine yourself starting a population. You could produce a population by mating a bunch of males and a bunch of females that have different gene frequencies. And in that case, P4-6 would not be equal to P6-4. There are some ways you can get an initial composition of the population in which that's not true. But once random mating has occurred, then it's going to be true. Because this here also means, of course, that A6, A4 is also equal to P4, P6, little P4, little P6. Is that somewhere near an answer to your question?
There's different
You're talking in which generation?
The parent generation.
In the parent generation, it could be that you have some of these and you don't have any of those. Now, biologically, they might be indistinguishable.
Right.
And in many cases, in almost all the cases we deal within the course, that'll be the case. It's more a bookkeeping convention, the way I'm doing it here. If you do it the other way, then it gets messier. The algebra looks a little worse. It still comes out the same. Okay. Let me just do a few minutes to set up the problem of what happens when the gene frequencies are different in the two sexes. We could have males with a particular combination. Let's go back to two alleles. you could have males that are, for example, some big A, big A's, and 40% heterozygotes and no little A's, that's in the males. In the females, you might have, somebody could start a population with 30% big A, zero of these, and 0.1 of little A. Okay, you can imagine that happening. So your pool of males and your pool of females just have different genotype frequencies.
You can add up to one.
They should, of course, add up to one. So we'll make that 0.7. I'm being stupid. Okay, there we go. 0.7. But you could imagine that. Now, what will the result be, and how will that work out in Hardy-Weinberg? The quick way of doing that is not to do all the mating types, but just simply to use the principles that we have and say, look, these males are going to produce gametes and contribute them to the gamete pool. At what frequency will there be big A's in those gametes? Well, it'll be the frequency we would get by just counting copies of big A's and little A's. Or another way of thinking of it is, what frequency of gametes will they produce? Mendelian reproduction, the Mendelian scheme, is equivalent to taking a random copy from each individual. And so what you'll get is, in this case, the genotype frequency of big A in the, I'll say, put a little M up here for male, will be what? What will the frequency of big A be among gametes from these males?
0.8.
0.8, okay. 0.6 plus half of that, 0.8. What will the frequency of big A be among females?
0.3.
Now, what will happen if I produce by random combination of gametes? So we have to distinguish now, not just have one big pot containing gametes, but we have to have a pot for the female gametes and a pot for the male gametes. And each offspring is going to be gotten by taking a dip into the male pot and a dip into the female pot and putting those gametes together. So what we do is we think of there being a little box, set of boxes, where you have the female gametes up here. There are big A and little a in frequencies 0.3 and 0.7. The male gametes down the side, big A and little a in frequencies 0.8 and 0.2. And if you do random combination, what you'll get are the products. So you'll get 0.3 times 0.8, or 0.24 of big A's. In this box, you'll get 0.56 of big A little A's. In this box, 0.06 of, this will be little A big A, so it's also a heterozygote. And over here, 0.14 of little A. Okay, so that's straightforward. It's what you'd get by just doing random combination of gametes. Now, where we're going from that is we're going to show you, with a little bit of algebra at the beginning of the next lecture, how this produces, that first of all, these are not going to be in Hardy-Weinberg proportions in this generation. They're going to, in fact, have too few homozygotes and too many heterozygotes. But we're also going to show you that what the gene frequency that results from this is, and that in the next generation they will pop into Hardy-Weinberg proportions and stay that way forever. So the result that we're going to have is that different frequencies in the two sexes lead to proportions that are not Hardy-Weinberg, but in the next generation you get back into Hardy-Weinberg proportions and stay there forever. I will do the algebra for that next time as at the beginning, and we'll be going on from there to really interesting case, which is when the alleles are not autosomal, but they're sex-linked. Then you get all kinds of bizarre behavior, and so mathematical types love it. Things act very differently. Yeah?
True for any linkage?
This is for, these are autosomal. They're regular
okay.
Loci. But what do you mean, what other cases are you?
Well, I guess sex linkage is different because then you always have different mate proportions of the male and female.
So yeah, sex linkage is different. We'll be doing that separately.
Yeah. But
this is no sex linkage here. Okay. So I passed the sign up sheet around for people who wanted to order copies of the book. First of all, what happened to it? Oh, it's up here. Okay. We have 10 people who signed up. If there's anybody else who wants to sign up that can see it, come up and do it. Pick up next time. And look at the homework. One of the problems in the homework has to do with linkage disequilibrium, which I haven't talked about yet, but we'll get to it in time.